Hi, everyone, and welcome to DevRaga Personal Finance. My name's DevRaga, and in this episode, we have a very special guest. Now, what's happened over the last maybe 6 weeks is that the interest rate hype has sort of died down a little bit. I think recently the RBA in Australia had a meeting and they decided to hold interest rates. And that spurred up a lot of demand amongst the medical community and the listener community about, okay, is this the right time to foray into home ownership, particularly when it comes to principal place of residence? So I reached out to This Is Money, Glenn, who basically pointed me in the right direction. And we have from Sphere Home Loans, Rachel Croon, who's going to tell us about how it actually works when it comes to mortgages and how can, you know, doctors, nurses, healthcare workers, is there anything different when they apply for their first mortgage or even commercial or investment properties? So welcome, Rachel, to DevRaga Personal Finance.
Thank you for having me.
So this episode, basically, we're going to talk about what is mortgage broking, you know, how do you prepare for a meeting, what are some of the payments and disclosure and cost involved, and we'll go really in depth into some of the focuses on interest rates. And also the second half of the episode, I want to really rein in and talk about, is it any different for healthcare workers, particularly who may be on slightly higher than average incomes? So Rachel, you ready to get started?
I am.
All right, let's get started.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Now, if you have any specific questions or comments, don't hesitate to contact us via Twitter or Facebook. And for Rachel, her details will be in the show notes for everyone to contact. And remember to leave a 5-star rating, don't forget. And remember the three main aims: education, empowerment, and entertainment. So, Rachel, tell us a little bit about yourself and what do you do for a living? Obviously, mortgage broking, but how did you get into that? I'm just curious what it takes to be a mortgage broker. And for all of you listening, I can't pronounce the word mortgage. I just can't do it. So I don't want any complaints and don't leave a negative review because of that. So just a disclosure.
Well, I've been in the industry for about 20 years. I started in the banking industry. So I started as a banker. I worked my way up to looking after a number of mortgage brokers for a major bank. So I was looking after the relationship between about 300 brokers and a major bank. And then I started my business, which is Sphere Home Loans, about 10 years ago. So I lead a team of about 7 mortgage brokers, and we work all across the country with people from all different backgrounds.
Okay. Are you based in New South Wales or
Victoria? We're based in New South Wales, but we do work nationally.
Okay. No worries. And I guess in terms of how do you become a mortgage broker, you said you're in the finance industry. So is there a qualification that you need to do before you become a mortgage broker, or you generally get into finance and do a subspecialty?
I think most mortgage brokers start in finance, but you don't need to. I think there is a qualification. There's a diploma that you need to do as a minimum qualification. And then you need to work under a mortgage broker for a few years before you can actually be a broker out seeing clients on your own.
Okay. So just to be clear, if I wanted to be a mortgage broker, I need some qualification and I need to do like an apprenticeship basically over a period of years.
That's correct.
Okay. And do mortgage brokers have to be associated with a governing body? For example, for doctors, we need to be registered with APRA, which is A-H-P-R-A, not A-P-R-A. Is there such a thing for mortgage brokers?
Yeah, we've got a choice of two. So there's the FBAA or the MFAA, and that's our governing body. So we need to become a member of that. So they do relevant checks on us first, both our education and our credit and our criminal history. And then they'll also have requirements for us to do a certain amount of training with them each year to remain compliant.
Okay, so very similar to healthcare workers. Have a governing body, registration, do what we call continuing professional development, to make sure that you're up to speed with your qualifications and skills. So if I was to, like, can you be a mortgage broker and not be associated with those two organisations? Is that still legit?
Most lenders won't allow you to have an accreditation with them unless you have those qualifications, so no.
Okay, right. So I guess it's not unusual to ask that question. If I was, you know, meeting up with a mortgage broker, I'd say, are you associated with those particular governing bodies, essentially? And that'd be a legit question to ask first up.
That is, and it becomes our compliance documents that we give to you before we start to engage with you in any way. It needs to disclose all of that as well.
Okay. And you mentioned that the banks that you deal with as a mortgage broker, so you have to deal with the client, which let's say it's me, and then you've got to deal with the banks. So you have to register yourself with each of those banks? I mean, there's like hundreds of them, isn't there?
That's right. So when we start, when we started the business, my first few months was just becoming accredited with 40 lenders. We have closer to 60 now, but it's you've still got to go through all of their training to become accredited. And each bank might have certain training that they require you to do each year to hold your accreditation with them.
Right. That sounds insanely complex. I mean, it sounds like, so there's no standardized accreditation, like you do one accreditation and you're accredited for the entire lenders. Each lender has their own?
Yeah, well, each lender has their own credit policies and the way that they work. So you need to understand the intricacies of each bank to be able to recommend them effectively.
Okay, that's interesting. So for all the healthcare workers that complain that you need to do your hand hygiene and your blood safe modules, your competencies at each network, when you might be only associated with two or three networks in Victoria, so stop complaining, because this sounds like horrendously more complex. And Rachel, I have an executive sort of role at one of the networks that I work in, and I'm constantly chasing up paperwork with doctors, you know, credentialing documents, you know, certified copies of their medical degree, and working with children's. And one of the number one sort of complaints that I get from clinicians, particularly doctors, nurses are far more easier to deal with, is that, why do I have to do this at each network? Well, you have to do it at each network because it's individualized, and you've explained it very well. You're not that far away from that process, having to do it in your profession. So that's interesting. I actually didn't know that. Now, let's say that I'm a average Joe or Julie and I want to buy a house. Let's assume I want to buy a house, principal place of residence. I've got two options, I suppose. One is I can go to my bank, who I deal with all the time, bank ABC, and go directly to the person there and deal with them. Or I can go to a mortgage broker. What I have noticed is, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that more and more people are going via a broker now than perhaps 10, 15 years ago. Is that anecdotal, or is there enough data to suggest that mortgage brokers are much more commonly used now than maybe 10, 15 years ago?
That's completely correct. And I think the last quarter that I looked at, it was 7 out of 10 Australian mortgage holders went to a mortgage broker for their mortgage. So that's 70% of people chose to engage a mortgage broker. Now, if I looked at that data 20 years ago, it probably would have been closer to 3 in 10. And I think it's because of education. I think people are becoming aware that choice is important. I think generations are changing to say that we want choice, and brokers offer that choice.
Right. So there's nothing wrong with going to your local bank, but I assume if you did that, you're kind of siloing yourself to that particular bank and being blinded to what's out there.
That's right. And the bankers at the branches do a marvelous job, but they only have the one product to offer.
Yeah. Okay. How do I prepare for a meeting with a mortgage broker? So I've selected them, they're accredited, they've got the credentialing, they've got great Google reviews. What do you need from me to bring to that first meeting?
Yeah, so a lot of the time the brokers are happy to have a standard chat. Some people want to have a meeting with us before they give us their information, and that might be for them to interview us and to talk a bit about their situation. That's fine. You can have an initial meeting before giving us any information. But if you want to have a really effective meeting with a broker, generally you'll do the fact find first. So you would contact our office, we would send you an online fact find, you would fill that out, you would upload your personal documents, which would be your pay slips. If you're self-employed, that would be your tax returns, any statements of debts that you have, your assets and liabilities, your expenses. And then when you sit down and have a meeting with a broker, it's an effective meeting. You can answer we can answer any questions that you may have because we've already had time to review all your information.
Okay. So at the first meeting, it can be on the get-go, have all that information handy, or have a first interview and then find out what information and then have a second meeting. Is there a cost to that? Like, do I have to pay you or the mortgage broker, whoever that is, to have that meeting?
No. So some brokers do charge a fee for advice, and that's absolutely fine. We don't. So we never charge a client at any point in the process. And that's worked really well for us over the last 10 years. I think if we do a good job, most people choose us for their mortgage. So even if you did use us for all that advice piece at the start and then didn't engage us, there would never be a cost.
Okay, cool. So there's no, I suppose, it's not compulsory. So no. Once you have that meeting, you can just walk away and say, no, not for me.
That's right.
And it's done online, because you work across the nation, so I assume Teams or Zoom or something like that.
Yeah, most of our meetings are done by Teams, and that changed a lot in COVID. Before COVID, we actually had to travel around to see clients, and that was really time consuming. But I think everybody's caught up and the banks have caught up with video meetings now. So most of our appointments are done via video meetings.
Okay. And in terms of, I guess, in this day and age of cybersecurity, I'm uploading my personal documents, my tax documents, my driver's license, all that sort of stuff to your portal. Is that portal, I'm assuming it's secure, it's encrypted, and is that something that only your business has access to, or do other brokers have access to that as well?
That's right. So we use our own encrypted secure portal. We have upgraded to a different portal after the Optus breach. I think about a year ago, we got a more complex portal, and we stopped encouraging people to email us their tax returns because that's what's getting hacked. It's email. So if you can use our portal rather than email, I feel like that's a safer forum for your documents to be stored. Those documents get held with our brokerage, and we don't pass those on to the bank until we have your permission to do so.
Okay, that was my next question. So let's say I have a meeting, I've uploaded my documents, and we walk our separate ways. That information that you have, I assume, gets destroyed or something. That's not passed on as data collection or something like that.
No, and we don't pass your data on to anybody else until you sign an application for a particular bank. And then you sign privacy consents for that particular bank. And that's where we can then share your data with that bank.
Yeah, so that's useful to know. So these are all sort of basic things that I've had questions from healthcare workers. You know, what happens to our data? Because everyone's really worried about the data. Now, what's interesting, Rachel, in the healthcare industry is a lot of it's done via email. So, you know, we send documents via email, things like professional development claims for flights and accommodation and credit card statements, and which is, you know, some networks have online processes, and I don't even know whether it's encrypted. I hope it is. Shout out to major networks. You better encrypt. But a lot of it's done via email. So it's interesting how your industry has really taken this security thing relatively seriously. You mentioned a little bit about the information that we need to upload. Now, a lot of healthcare workers are self-employed. You mentioned about tax returns. Does it have to be like 2 years' worth? Is that the base?
Generally, I like to have everything up front. So I like to get 2 years, and sometimes I ask for three, and all of the information that could possibly be asked. And then we work with what we might need to give each bank. So some banks might just need the 1 year in isolation. Some banks don't need tax returns. If you're a company paying yourself a salary, sometimes we're just giving that bank a notice of assessment or a pay slip, but we get everything before we can make a decision on what's going to be best for you.
Okay. And you said you use the term lenders as opposed to banks. So, I mean, what's the difference between like going to a lender who may not be a bank as opposed to like a big four bank, for example? Is there much of a difference?
It's personal preference. If I looked at my preference of my clients, I use mainly the banks. I use major banks a lot. And that's just my client's preference. But there are options out there for all sorts of different lenders. A lot of clients have a particular need to go to a lender that isn't a banking institution.
Okay. So, for example, I bank with one of the big fours. I've been with them for years and years and years. So if I went through a mortgage broker like yourself and you contact the same bank that I'm with, I could get a different deal as opposed to me walking into a branch and applying in that same bank.
That's correct. So there have been cases where we've had clients that have been with a private banker at a major bank, and that we have reviewed their lending and placed them back at that same bank, but under, our negotiation. So you don't have to move banks to engage a mortgage broker.
Yeah, okay. So that's important to know. And there's no hard feelings, right? I mean, my bank's not going to get, upset because I've gone via a mortgage broker rather than come directly to them.
And there have been cases where the private banker have matched our rate and the client said, we're actually going to stay with this private banker. We're not going to engage you. And that's fine as well. It's personal choice. I mean, our job is just to provide options. And we don't have every client that comes to see us doesn't stay with us. Sometimes their private banker works really hard to keep them.
Yeah, so that's really, really useful. So I'll sort of elaborate on that sort of private banker for people that haven't heard of that term. So basically, if you have a certain amount of income, certain amount of net wealth, some of these banks would offer you what they call a personal business manager that sort of looks after your sort of, financial, wealth. Sometimes they're a little bit salesy. They try and sort of sell you stuff as well. So for people that don't have access to that, you can still go to the local branch and speak to the branch person who's in charge of mortgages, or you can still go via mortgage brokers. For people that have access to that, you can still go via mortgage brokers. You don't have to go via your own private banker, which is important to know, because a lot of people don't know that. They feel, particularly in the healthcare industry, and particularly this applies to doctors, a lot of us have private bankers. I have a private banker, in full disclosure, with one of the big fours, and I make it very transparent that I am shopping around constantly for, better deals. And there's no offense caused. And like you said, a lot of the private bankers don't mind at all. So that's really important to know. Which comes to the next topic about payments and disclosures, right? So we don't pay you. We, as in the end client, doesn't pay the mortgage broker. So how do you get paid? And how is that disclosed and how does it all work?
Yeah, so people always get worried that there's a cost involved in a mortgage broker because there's nothing for free. But how it actually works is the bank has two sections. They've got their first party, which is their branches. And in their first party, they've got rent in all of those big shopping centres. They've got their branch managers, their lenders, and they're paying fixed costs. And their fixed costs are what they have to pay to bring in mortgages and clients. They've also got their third party, which is their broker channel, which is they pay us an upfront commission and a trailing commission for settled loans. When I worked for the bank, our third party section, which is where I worked, was actually our cheaper acquisition channel for a client because we're only paying for settled loans. We're not paying all these fixed costs. So yes, there is an upfront and a trailing commission paid to a broker, but the client doesn't pay that. The bank pays that rather than paying their own fixed costs in their first party channel.
Okay. So, and just to elaborate on that, is it the same across all banks? So is your trailing commissions or your upfront fees that they pay you, is it the same across all banks and lenders or is it different?
It's slightly different, just depending on the bank. I actually don't know what we get paid from the banks. It's not something that I investigate, but let's say one bank might pay, slightly more upfront and one might pay slightly more trailing commission, but it all seems to come out in the wash. All the major banks and all the banks that we use are very, very close. It'd be negligible, the difference between them. Some lenders that do pay a little bit more might be the non-conforming lenders. So you see those lenders that, traditionally help people that have, tough credit or something like that, or a reason to go to a non-conforming lender. Sometimes they do pay a little bit more, but your major banks are all very, very close.
Okay. And I think it's relevant because you're right. There's a lot of skepticism when things, there's this saying, nothing is for free. It sort of gets thrown around. And in your case, well, nothing is for free in the sense that the client doesn't have to pay you, but you do get paid, and rightfully so, because it is a business and you deserve to get paid. And there are some variations. I guess the other question that I've had is, does that mean that your sort of payment, for example, for your own business, is that individualized or do you know if it's kind of standardized? For example, if I'm a big bank, I'm going to pay Rachel the same sort of commissions as opposed to I'm going to pay, another mortgage broker, or is it like really individualized for your business?
It's all the same across the board. They have lenders that they pay. Before the Royal Commission, there used to be bonuses that they'd pay if you gave a certain amount of business to a bank. There were things that that the Royal Commission came out and said, well, you can't have those big overseas trips paid for the bank anymore, and that's all stopped. But standard payments is pretty much the same. I have seven brokers in my team and they all get paid a salary. When I started this business, it was really important for me to make sure that the people that were in front of clients were incented to do the right thing by the client. So even if staying with their bank is the right thing, I guess they're going to get paid either way, even if they give that advice, where if they were commission-based, that might not be the case.
Yeah, so that's an interesting phenomenon that I've noticed in the healthcare industry as well. There seems to be a lot of parallels, is that these self-employed doctors, after a while, they just get, you know, they just want to go to a salaried profession. They don't want to get paid per fee-for-service. And I think having that sort of security is really important. And I guess the other thing is, in the insurance industry, I did a recent episode with Phil Thompson from Sky Wealth, and all of their sort of commissions and all of their sort of fees is all standardised. And this was something that came out of the Royal Commission as well, or some sort of independent inquiry, because otherwise you kind of incentivize to go with one specific insurance company or one specific lender because they are giving you these bonuses. So it's really important and clear up that there is not much difference. So there's no incentive for your mortgage broker to go to one particular lender unless it's just a better product.
That's right. And sometimes there is a case where a bank or a lender gives us something special and we disclose it to the client. That thing that might be special might be really quick turnaround times. So we give a certain amount of business to this bank and they give us really quick turnaround times. We might be saying to the client, look, this bank's going to give you 24-hour turnaround times because we give them this much volume. We disclose that. And if it benefits the client, great. But everything's about disclosure and being transparent.
Correct. Yeah, exactly. And the analogy in the healthcare industry is GPs refer to non-GP specialists, not because of the cost or anything like that. It's because some of the non-GP specialists just communicate much more in a transparent, open way and just send out those letters back quickly. So I have a list of non-GP specialists that I refer to because they just answer my text 24/7 if I've got a patient that I need to refer to them. So it's just easier. Then those commissions, that sort of your, you know, payments that you get, does that then get disclosed to the client? Like if I'm signing a loan document, does it actually mention it all that, or is that even relevant?
It is relevant and it does get disclosed. So we give you what's called a credit proposal. So when you choose a bank, or actually before you choose a bank, after we've had our initial meeting, we're going to send you a credit proposal and it will have maybe the last five lenders that we compared for you. It will have all of their information about, you know, what your rates are going to be, the features they have in those things, and we'll give a recommendation, but ultimately you will choose. And part of that is what they pay us. So we actually disclose in that credit proposal what our commissions will be for each lender, and you can see fully what our commissions will be upfront and our trailing commission. So you get to see that. Some clients say, wow, you get paid this much for the loan. And I say, yeah, you have to remind them that they're not paying it.
Yeah, fair enough. And look, I think that's relevant because in the online forums, and there's actually specific online forums for healthcare workers about money and on Facebook, there's a lot of myths about this because one of the myths is we never get to find out what the trailing commissions are, or we never get to find out, you know, what the payments go to the brokers. Actually, we do. We just need to read the document, which is, you know, however many pages. So it's important that, you know, that we get it out there transparent and being honest and say, it's all out there. Just bloody read the document. So that's important. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's important to note that we have our own fixed costs. So that's not something that we just bank. We still have to pay for staff and all the processing of that loan, our own rent. And so we're paying all those fixed costs that the bank pay themselves.
That's right. That's right. And look, you know, rising cost of living pressures also means rising cost of running a business, which there's so much focus on consumers, which I get it. I think people are struggling, the, you know, inflationary pressures, etc. But to run a business, well, guess what? If my home electricity bill goes up, your business electricity bill also goes up, which means that's why some of the businesses have to jack up their rates. So it's an economic feedback loop, which I think sometimes gets missed in the media cycle because there's so much focus on the actual consumer. And rightly so, there should be. Now, there's so much obsession about interest rates on a Tuesday afternoon once a month, right? And I don't know whether this is a unique Australian thing. I don't know. a fair bit of North American listeners, I don't know if everyone just turns on the TV, but it's becoming a bit of an obsession because of what's happened over the last couple of years. And if you look at the online discussions, there's so much focus on that interest rate. What interest rates are you getting, Dev? I'm getting this interest rate. I'm getting that interest rates, right? Is interest rates really the be-all end-all? And should we just stop this as obsession?
I think that interest rates are important, and I think it's one of many factors that you need to consider when you're choosing a product in a bank. I think that people are more focused than usual at the moment because we're in a really, I guess we've had a rising environment, and we haven't had a rise like this so consistently in my time in the industry, which is why people are so focused on it. It's affecting them day to day. And there's been a huge amount of rate rises. So people are caught up in rate because it's affecting their lives. This is not a usual cycle. People don't usually focus this much on interest rates, but they're so high at the moment that it's a big factor. It's definitely something that you need to consider as part of your overall financial strategy, what your rate is.
Yeah, no worries. So it is one of the factors, but it's something that's it's mentioned a lot. What's interesting is I bought my first house in Melbourne in 2009, and my interest rate at the time was 7.9%. And since then, it had consistently declined, you know, up until, you know, relatively recently. And I obviously paid off that mortgage ages ago. But what I did was I just kept the interest rate at the same amount, and I just assumed that it was the same interest rate and just paying it off really, really quickly. And that's a really easy way to just pay off your mortgage. Is there such a thing as a fixed rate? Because in Australia, you can fix your rates, I think, for a maximum of 5 years. Correct me if I'm wrong. Whereas our North American colleagues, they can fix their rates for 30 years. And can you get an offset, 100% offset, with a fixed rate in Australia?
That American system of fixing for 30 years blows my mind because fixing in Australia is very different. Fixing is quite rigid once you fix a loan. So fixing is something that you really need to research before you do. It's something that you're entering a contract and there's a time in that contract and there can be exit fees based on how long you fix for. So fixed rates are great. I don't know whether fixing is that popular at the moment because we're heading into a declining rate environment. So generally that's not the time that people tend to fix. But if you did have a fixed loan, you might choose generally, some banks do a 10-year fixed loan, but I have never seen a client fix for more than five in Australia in the time that I've been in this industry. But it's you can have some banks offer offset on their fixed loans. Most don't. The most common scenario would be that you would choose a package that has a feature that you could have some variable and some fixed. And you would link your offset to your variable portion. But there is one or two banks that do allow offset on fixed loans. But more commonly, clients would leave a variable portion of their loan. And the variable loan is what you can offset and have the full flexibility with. And the fixed portion is, I know what my rate's going to be. I know what my repayment's going to be. And that's my fixed portion of the loan.
Yeah, it's interesting. So I actually spoke to a doctor about sort of 3 months ago who had no idea what an offset was. So what they were doing was they had a home loan and they had all this money sitting in a high interest savings account. And I said, oh, have you ever heard about an offset? And he goes, no, never heard about it. And, you know, they've been a doctor for like 10 years. And I'm like, that's insane. Like, I mean, this is the most basic information that should be out there, but some people don't know it's out there. So can you just briefly explain an offset account versus a redraw? Because this often gets sort of thrown around quite a bit.
Okay, so I'm going to start by saying the difference in offset and redraw is really big when we're talking about tax implications and if we're talking about if something's tax deductible or not. So if a property is going to be an investment property down the track or it is an investment property, this is where the big difference between offset and redraw comes into play, and your accountant will explain that further. But fundamentally, a redraw is a feature of a home loan. So your home loan may have the feature of redraw, and that means that you can make additional repayments, but then you can redraw those repayments to use as you like. An offset account is a bank account that links to your home loan It's a separate facility, but the bank calculates the interest owing based on your home loan minus whatever amount is in your offset account, and that's what you get charged interest on. Some banks have a fully featured offset account, like it's just like a bank account with key cards and it's on your internet banking. Some banks have a rigid offset account where you can only move money into it via internet banking. So when you are picking an offset account, the features linked to that are important as well. Some banks have multiple offset accounts, so you can have a whole stack of them. And if you like to save your money in separate savings accounts, which people do, you might have multiple offset accounts. But if your interest rate on your home loan is 6%, you're essentially getting 6% tax-free on your savings, rather than, I guess, in an interest account, you're getting a lot lower than that, but you're also paying tax on the interest.
Yeah, that's right. So that's good. So the key point there is with redraw is extra repayments that you've paid onto the mortgage that you can then take back. It's extra repayments. Whereas with an offset, it's actually just a plain old offset. So if you've got a $100,000 mortgage.
If you've got a $100,000 mortgage and then you've got $100,000 in an offset account, you're essentially paying no interest on that mortgage. But you've got the flexibility out of that offset account to take that money and do whatever you like with it. And that the debt on that property is still that $100,000. And that's the important part for your accountant to note.
That's right. And you still have to pay the repayments every month. It's not as if your repayments are zero.
It depends if you're paying a principal. It depends if you're paying principal and interest or interest only. See, I have a lot of clients that would get interest only loans and have the amount of offsetting the loan. And if it's an interest only loan, it's not looking for a repayment each month because the interest only repayment is zero. It's because they're calculating the two. But if it was a principal and interest loan, it's still seeking a repayment every month, but all of that repayment is going off the principal and there's no interest payable.
Okay. So if the intention is to buy a property and you want to eventually upgrade to another property and you want to make your current property an investment, really your offset account is a really nice way to do that. And it just makes it very clean, simple for the tax person or the accountant.
That's basically right. So if you're anything that's going to be an investment property, offsets are very important.
Now, in terms of the levers that you can pull for clients, so one of the levers is offset redraw, the other lever is turnaround time of applications, the other lever is interest rates. What are the other levers that you can pull as a mortgage broker to get the best deal for your client, and the client meaning me?
So if we're talking about rate, so all the features are going to be the same. So the bank has features already. We can't change those. But the lever that we have to pull is rate. And we negotiate the rate based on the overall risk profile of the client and the appetite of the bank. So if you had a lot of lending and you're a doctor, I'm going to go to the bank not just with the amount of lending that you have, but I'm also going to disclose your profession because doctors are traditionally lower risk than some of the other professions. So that comes into play when they're looking at risk because their rate isn't just on the amount of lending, it's on the risk for the bank. So I guess being a doctor, you might have a little bit of extra pull when you're negotiating your rates as well.
Okay. And is it just a profession as a whole, or do you look at the type of doctor or the type of nurse? So for example, if you were an anaesthetist or a surgeon or a proceduralist, does that change your negotiating power as opposed to if you're a non-proceduralist community practitioner or a pediatrician, for example?
If we're talking just about rate, it might come into it slightly because you might not have enough lending to reach their big caps of where they're going to give you a better rate. But we might say, well, that's a specialist. And so he's probably going to get there. So let's give him that rate now with the trajectory of what his lending will be. But if we're looking at different credit policies, if somebody's wanting to get into the market and we're trying to negotiate, waivers of different credit policies, that would come into play a lot more as well.
Okay, cool. And that sort of goes into borrowing capacity, right? I mean, if I make more money, I can borrow more money. So does that mean that if I've already got a significant amount of debt with a particular bank, then could I come to a mortgage broker like yourself and say, I've actually got a significant amount of debt, I can completely service it, I've got a very high income. Can you then go to the bank and say, hey, Dev's got this massive amount of debt, he's got a very high income, therefore your rate can be further negotiated down because you use the principle of a small bite out of a watermelon as opposed to a bigger bite out of a grape. So watermelon being the amount of debt, if they just reduce a little bit of interest rate, they still make more money.
Yeah, you could definitely negotiate based on your aggregate borrowing, so your overall borrowing and risk. And LVR comes into play in that as well. So the percentage of your loan versus the value of your property. So all different banks have different sweet spots that they're looking for business at the time. I had a client recently and they were a 58% lend and it was about $4 million in lending. So I know that there's certain banks that they're looking for big loans under 60% right now. So I knew I was going to have fun with that loan getting it priced. So we went to the banks and played them off against each other and got the best possible rate. If that had been 75% LVR, I would have had less banks playing for the business.
Okay. And in terms of the cost to set it all up, so apart from obviously I don't pay anything to yourself, for example, obviously the usual mortgage setup cost and stuff, that's all just fixed based on the lender. Is there any other costs that I need to be worried about that they might package into the loan?
Yeah, so other than, people think it's an application fee or evaluation fee, and some lenders do have those, but the vast majority of clients get a package, and that package has an annual fee that might be $395, and that covers your application, your valuation, and all your ongoing fees. So that gets paid up front when you go to a lender. So that's one of the costs that we do allow for, but there might be a couple of $100 in lenders' legals. There might be a couple of $100 in government legals of registering a mortgage. But generally, the cost to refinance from one bank to another might be, we might allow $1,000. Everything else is, you know, either government charges like stamp duty if you're buying a property, or if you're borrowing more than a certain percentage, it's lender's mortgage insurance. And that's where the bank takes out an insurance policy against you as a risk. And that tends to be the bigger cost that people are dealing with when they're buying higher percentage loans.
Yeah. And just to clarify, LMI or the lender's mortgage insurance, that's to protect the banks, the lender, right? That's not to protect me.
Yeah, no, that's an insurance that the bank takes out against you as a risk. So if you were doing a 95% lend, your mortgage insurance premium would be a lot higher than if you were doing a 90% lend. Generally and traditionally, banks charge mortgage insurance over 80%. But there might be different professions that don't pay that mortgage insurance, and some banks might go, well, we'll do 85% without mortgage insurance, and different banks do different things.
Okay. And what's interesting about that, which is, so when I get insurance through, let's say I get my car insured, I pay the premium and it protects me. But in this case, correct me if I'm wrong, the lender's mortgage insurance gets charged to me. So I'm paying for that, but it's protecting the lender.
100%. And that's something that we really need to explain to clients, to say you still need to get your own relevant insurances. This is only an insurance that the bank's charging you against their risk.
That's right. So we're paying for their risk. So it often gets misconcepted and construed as loan protection insurance, which is completely different. That's if you lose your job or whatever, you have to get your own loan protection insurance. That's completely different. So just want to be absolutely clear, the LMI is not the same as loan protection insurance. It's actually not an uncommon question that I get from a lot of healthcare workers, which
That's
is interesting.
Right. And some people have to pay mortgage insurance, but we do a lot of work to try to avoid it if we can.
Sure. Is there a standard sort of thing, like if you're a healthcare worker, doctor, nurse, physio, pharmacy, do most lenders now sort of say 80% is not the rule, it's 90%? Is there such sort of blanket rules?
It's not most lenders, it's some lenders. Most major banks will say, if you're a doctor, we'll go to 90% without mortgage insurance. But some lenders will do it for all different sorts of professions, like doctors, accountants, a podiatrist. Something that has come onto the Medico for a few banks is at the 90% no mortgage insurance is registered nurses, which we're really excited about. That's been a game changer for so many of our clients. But there's different levels that the banks will do, but all different banks have different policies of how they handle that.
Yeah, I mean, I've spoken to quite a few nurses that are on more than $200,000, $250,000 a year because, you know, they have their primary job and they locum. They do a lot of agency work, which is great. I think presumably healthcare workers on a whole and people like accountants and certain professions, you know, lenders would consider as lower risk, and therefore they're happy to lend more and avoid that sort of LMI insurance, which I think is fair enough. Yep.
Yeah, but there was one particular bank, a major bank, doesn't have optometry in their medico policy, and a client of ours was about to pay mortgage insurance, and then they actually listened to one of Glenn's podcasts and they gave us a call, and we took them to a bank that did have 90% no mortgage insurance. So your banker doesn't necessarily need to tell you if somebody else has a better policy for you, which is really important to note.
Yeah, that's important. Yeah, and it's all about choice, which is what you mentioned earlier in the episode. There's this thing about comparison rates, which often I see on TV and ads and in the media. What does that actually mean?
So the comparison rate rule came out, that was about 20 years ago that the banks started to have to disclose comparison rates. And it was there to stop people getting tricked with these low intro rates. So the comparison rate is fundamentally, it goes over 30 years and says, with 30 years of all of the fees and charges built into this loan, this is the real and true rate. So if the comparison rate is close to the actual rate, it probably isn't going to jump up and it probably doesn't have a lot of fees attached to it. But 15 years ago, there was a lot of intro rates. So, you know, you might get a rate of 5% today, but in 12 months' time, it jumps up to 6%. And the comparison rate stopped people getting tricked with that. More often than not now, people are getting a package and we negotiate a package discount and they get that discount for the life of the loan. So the comparison rate really is quite close to the true rate. It's just showing the annual fee. The comparison rate can get confusing when you're doing things like a fixed rate loan though, because it's much higher. And you think, why is that comparison rate so much higher? Well, you're fixing at a low rate, but then after that fixed rate, it goes over to the standard variable, which is quite high. The truth is you wouldn't roll over to that variable. You'd renegotiate at the time and get a lower rate. So most mortgages last 3 to 5 years, not the 30 years that the comparison rate's actually quoting.
Right. Okay. That's useful to know. Yeah, I did notice the comparison rate was more of a prominent thing, particularly in the last sort of 10 or 15 years. You know, it sort of brings me back to, I actually tried to book a flight in the United States, internal flights, and their system is insane where they advertise a particular price and then by the time you end up in the checkout, it's actually like 300 times more than what the advertised price was, and it's because there's all these other fees like luggage handling fees. Well, I would have thought that's part of actually your cost of flying an airplane, fees about, you know, security fees and this fees and that fees and seat selection. And if I remember right, in Australia, some years ago, we had a very similar, so they used to advertise $9 flights to Melbourne to Sydney. And then by the time you clicked right at the end, the actual flight price was like $150. And I think we're not allowed to advertise like that. So I think that's the analogy for comparison rate. Now, first homeowners grant, I'm assuming that as a mortgage broker, you'd help win that process?
Yeah, that's right. So there's a first homeowners grant, but there's also a number of different state-based and national-based incentives. So a lot of first home buyers are navigating their way through using one or more of those when they're buying their first home. And we help with that process.
Yeah, that's right. So I don't have to worry about that. You kind of know all the legislation for each state and territories. That's important. Is it actually, so there's two grants, is there? So there's a federal first homeowners grant and there's a state-based. Is that right?
Yeah, well, the first homeowners grant was the tradition where they pay a fee, they pay an amount of money. So that's really only for new property, but the government incentives and schemes, they're not paying money, they're waiving certain fees. So it might be in New South Wales, it might be that you don't pay stamp duty if you're buying a house up to $800,000 and you haven't owned property before. But another government incentive is you might use what's called a first home buyer's guarantee, which is that they'll cover the mortgage insurance if you've just got a 5% deposit. But there's different income requirements for that, and that's a nationally based scheme, and the stamp duty is state based, and that changes between states.
Yeah, when I first bought my first house, stamp duty is something that I didn't prepare for. And if you're sort of listening in and you're thinking about buying your first home, it's a stinger, because depending on the amount of money that you spend on the house. It's kind of like when you get your first paycheck and about 40% goes of it to the tax and you're like, bloody hell, more taxes. Can I ask, is there like a standard percentage of stamp duty or is it different between each state?
It changes between each state. And New South Wales, New South Wales is actually quite fair comparatively to Melbourne. Brisbane can be a little bit less, but there was a change last year in New South Wales that actually lifted the stamp duty concession from, say, $650,000 to over $800,000 now. So more people are getting stamp duty concessions when they're buying their first home.
And also time frame. So if I come to you, let's say this is day zero, we have our meeting, I've uploaded everything. How long does it take for the process for you to be able to negotiate, get me the best rate? What's the time frame we're talking about here?
Yeah, look, it depends if it was, if you're refinancing from one bank to another and rate's the most important thing for you, we might take 3 or 4 days to wait for all the banks to come back and get the rate. But if you came to us and said, look, I've exchanged on this property and I've got 5 days to get my finance approved, we're going to choose a bank based on their timeframes. So you might say, well, what's important to me is not waiting 20 days for a loan application. So we're only going to compare banks that are going to do that in a quick time frame. But we can turn around things in less than a week if people need them to. But if you choose a bank that has a 17-day wait, then we would tell you that up front. But then there might be the 17-day wait to hold for that particular feature or a fixed rate that you're waiting for in that queue.
Okay. And last question before you go on a break, and then after the break, I've got some specific examples with a focus on high income earners. When should people approach you? Is it before they bid at the auction, I hope? Or is it like, have they got a pre-approval? Like, how does it all that? When do you want people, assume it early as possible?
You would be surprised how many contracts we get in our office on a Monday morning of people who have gone and bought property before they've seen us. It happens all the time, and they've got 5 days to get their finance approved, and that puts everybody in a high-pressure situation. But if that's the case, that's the case that we'll work with. But ideally, it would be before you're looking to buy, you would engage a mortgage broker to look at your options, do the research, work out your strategy, get your pre-approval in place, and then you'd go and buy a home.
Yeah, right. Okay. Well, one of my close friends actually did exactly that. So they went and he didn't understand how the process worked. This was a while ago, and he actually bid on an auction in Brunswick and bought the house, and then they panicked because they actually haven't got a pre-approval, they haven't got anything. And of course, with auction, it's kind of unconditional. And it was just a mad rush to make sure that he could actually afford to buy the property. And thankfully, he could. So it's interesting that people still make that mistake.
Yeah. And it's, I guess it's not a huge, it's not a huge thing because we can negotiate rates very close between the banks. If you have to choose a bank that's going to work very quickly, I don't think you're necessarily going to get penalised for that. I think the biggest downfall would be your own stress in those days that you need to get it approved.
Yeah, look, transparency, just make sure we get in as early as possible. If you don't know, just ask and just do some Google, Google research. Now, funny story before we go on a break, I've had patients that have been allergic to things, and then because the doctor didn't ask their allergies, they felt pressurized to take the same medication they're allergic to. Penicillin's probably the most common. It's actually pretty funny and also very sad. And then upon reviewing the adverse effect, when you interview the patient, well, why didn't you just tell the doctor that you're allergic to penicillin? And they said, well, the doctor never asked and I felt bad telling them. But you're anaphylactic to penicillin. That's important information. And they said, no, I just felt obliged to take the penicillin because the doctor prescribed and I didn't want to, cause any fuss. Well, just ask. If you don't know, just ask. Do some Googling, do some preparation. Making a biggest purchase of your life, dare I say, it's important. Don't just randomly bid at auctions, although it's very tempting. We'll just take a quick break. When we come back, I've got some specific questions for Rachel. In the setting of high income earners, these are specific questions from some people that I've had a chat to in recent times. So we'll be right back.
If you're after personal financial advice, don't get it from a podcast. If you would like help based on your own personal situation, head over to sortyourmoneyout.com. Click Get Help and we'd be happy to introduce you to one of our trusted advisors. Our panel of advisors, mortgage brokers and accountants work with clients all over Australia so they can connect with you wherever you are. That's sortyourmoneyout.com and click Get Help.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
All right, welcome back. We're with Rachel Croon from Sphere Home Loans, who's kindly donated her time to talk about mortgage broking. Question for you, Rachel, what are the buffers used when people apply for home loans? I assume the lenders have a buffer.
Yeah, that's right. So traditionally the buffer is 3% above the actual rate. So right now a home loan rate might be 6%, but when you are doing the bank stress test, when we're working out your serviceability in their calculators, it's actually 9% that they're using, or 3% above whatever the rate is.
Right. And I think I've got mates in America. I'm not sure if they have the same buffer. They probably don't. Do you think that's one of the reasons why the Australian market is so robust despite having 13 or 14 interest rate rises consecutively in a very short time? The number of mortgagee auctions, or the number of people actually going bankrupt as a result of not being able to pay, it's actually a relatively low amount. Is that why? Because we've got a pretty robust buffer?
Yeah, so there was a lot, even when rates were 2% and 1%, the bank's buffers were probably about where they are now. So everybody who's in the rates that they are now, even though we've had all those rises, they can afford the loans that they're in. They've just had to adjust their lifestyle to accommodate that.
Yeah, which is really, really good. And I think that's one of the things that I think Australia is, I think we as a country are very good at. We have got very good, you know, compared to other countries, regulations and governance around this issue, as opposed to some other countries. I'm going to single out America, which is exactly why people couldn't afford to pay their mortgages when the GFC happened, because they were getting loans they frankly couldn't afford. And they had those sort of intro rates, was what you're talking about. And I don't know whether in the US they have this comparison rate phenomenon, but essentially what happened is people get these interest rates, which are very low, and then after a year or two, it goes to very high rates and they weren't aware of it and it wasn't transparent. And of course, what happens when that happens? The whole system burns, which we don't want to happen in Australia. So I'm thankful for that. Specifics about high income earners, right? This is a real case. So I've got a mate who's an orthopedic surgeon. And for people that don't know, orthopedic surgeons make a fair amount of money. But of course, to get to that stage, the poor guy has sold his soul. Like, he's been training for, like, I don't know, 15 years or something. So it's hard work. And he said, "Dev, I'm really, you know, wanting to buy a house in that sort of, you know, $4 to $5 million range." That's sort of his budget. Is the process for him the same as any other home buyer, or is there any differences that he needs to be aware of at that level of purchase?
I think at that level of purchase, the process would pretty much be the same, but he would just, because the bigger the loan, the more important the interest rate, he'd just work a little harder to negotiate. So it would be having his mortgage broker really work hard at playing the banks off against one another, because he needs to get the best rate that he can. He's got such a high level of lending. But depending on what his short and long-term goals are, there might be other things that he would need to consider other than rate. It might be who's going to lend him the amount of money to borrow the house that he wants, because all the banks have different policies on that. It might be if he's going to buy another property down the track, who's going to allow him to put the least amount of deposit in to enable him to pivot and do the next step. So it's going to be the same process. They're just going to have to negotiate a little bit harder to make sure they get the best rate possible.
Okay. And the principles of trying to avoid LMI, that's all kind of the same, you know, and try and negotiate as much as possible. So, I mean, LMI for him would be really expensive, I would have thought.
Well, because he's an orthopedic surgeon, I mean, doctors pretty much at 90%, there's no mortgage insurance at any bank that's going to have a medical policy. We can lend, like, there's different banks that do different things. Some will do 95% for doctors. I've seen as high as 100% with a certain little, you know, a few little things that they've done to you know, facilitate that in the background, but there tends to be a cost involved in that. So I would say the majority of medical professionals that we have come to us would do a 90% lend because they can get the absolute best rate as well as put in the least amount of deposit to facilitate their goals.
That's right. Why do you want to spend your own money more than what you have to? And then if you've got extra money to spend, just put it on the offset. It's kind of the same thing, isn't
it? That's right. I mean, anything higher than that, they might go the higher products if they have to get in, but there might be a cost involved in that. So it always is a negotiation between what's important to you.
Okay, yeah. So it's good to know that the process for him, despite being a high income earner, despite having aspirations to buy a house, you know, well in excess of the average person, the process and the systems that we have is relatively the same with a few levers here or there. That's important to know.
Now, if he was looking at buying this house maybe before he finished his specialist training, he might not be able to borrow what he wants. His income might actually not have, you know, 2 years ago, his income might not have been high enough to borrow the house that he wants to buy. And we might be able to use something like in the medical divisions of the bank, sometimes we can get special things approved that we can't do for other people, which it might be he's doing a specialist training and I might put a case study together to say this is what his income will be in 2 years' time. Can I use that projected income based on the fact that you know that he will be earning this? And we can get things like that approved for medical professionals because it's so standardized what they will be earning.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I think that's really important to know because in this particular case, I mean, he's a consultant specialist. He's done his training, but a lot of listeners are junior doctors, junior nurses who go through a training program. So their earning capacity does increase as they go along the training journey, as they become, you know, specialists in their own right. For example, you're a nurse, you do general nursing, and you might want to do ICU nursing. You might want to do cardiac nursing, which pays a little bit more than the average nurse. You might want to be a specialist ED nurse with care training. So that's relevant. And of course, it depends on the profession, particularly for junior doctors who have aspirations to buy property. Junior doctors, you know, don't get really paid very well across the board in Australia for the amount of hours that they do. They kind of get shafted, but, you know, we're trying to fix that as a nation. So shout out to the juniors who are out there slaving away right at this moment. But as they go on that journey of their training and as they become fellows, hopefully, you know, their income increases. So that's a really relevant point. What about people that have families? So, you know, mum, dad, brothers, uncles, aunts who have property. You know, my parents have property, multiple. My brother has multiple properties. I have multiple properties. Can that be used as a leverage if we all go to a mortgage broker and say, hey, we want you to really negotiate hard because we've got this big pie of property portfolio, which is, you know, worth a fair bit of money. Is that something that people do? Is that even an option?
It is something that people do. In these cases, we would tend to go to the private bank. So we would go to a major bank, we'd go to their private bank section, and we'd find a private banker that we work with in that section, and we'd take the case and we'd negotiate based on overall lending and what this connection is going to bring to the bank. And an example of that would be I had a client recently in Melbourne. He was a very high income earner, but he was borrowing a high percentage of lend. So his rate wouldn't have been as good as, you know, his father would have been at, you know, 80% of his complete portfolio. We negotiated his rate based on his family's relationship with the bank. So I took him to the bank that I knew that we'd put his father with years before, and we talked about the overall relationship, and the bank came back and approved it based on relationship.
That's really interesting. And look, I'm all about building relationships. I'm all about, I'll talk about the three A's of medicine, you know, availability, affability, and ability. And that's really nice to know that option is there because, you know, we're a diverse population in Australia. You know, I'm from an Indian background. It's not unusual in the Southeast Asian community and subcontinental community and a lot of the Mediterranean communities. We pool our money together. We buy assets in bulk. I mean, you go to certain suburbs in Melbourne, there are joint families that live under the same house. That's really interesting to know that option is there. And I suspect if that option is there, that should be explored, particularly using that as a collective bargaining chip from an asset pool perspective. Now, I did talk a little bit about loan protection insurance, which is different to LMI. Does mortgage broking industry, do they deal with that as well? So as you get a mortgage and you sort of settle on that, do you also help negotiate a loan protection insurance, or is that completely separate?
It's completely separate. So we can't give, I'm not a financial planner, so I can't give any advice on protection. But what I can do is say that you need to talk to somebody. So if we're giving you this big loan against this asset, we need to tell you that you also need to protect that loan or protect that asset. And the way to do that is to have protection in place for your income. So we'd refer you to somebody like Phil at Sky Wealth to say, have a chat to somebody and make sure that you've got adequate protection in place.
Yeah, so shout out to Phil that we did an episode recently on this topic about personal insurance, et cetera. So protecting and having foundational protection for your wealth is really important. Let's talk about penalties, right? I mean, is it fair to say that if you have a variable mortgage with 100% offset, which is probably the most common, you're buying your first home, what if I want to pay off my home, you know, within that sort of 25, 30-year loan period? Is there a standard penalty for that? Or what are some of the catches that people need to watch out for?
Yeah, so if as long as you don't fix your loan, as long as you keep a variable rate mortgage, you're fluid and there's no penalties in moving around. The only thing you need to check is if you do fix your loan, there's penalties, but it actually became illegal to charge exit fees for banks to charge exit fees on non-fixed loans a number of years ago. So there were some of the banks that did charge an exit fee if you left within a few years. That's not the case anymore. So as long as you're variable, you can pay your loan off or refinance or pay it down. There should be no penalty involved. If you fix your loan, and this is where it gets tricky with fixing, the bank can charge you a fee, but it's based on their economic loss. So that's an unascertainable amount. So they can't tell you what the fixed rate loan break fee could be. I've had a client come to me, and when they're actually going through a divorce, so they had no choice but to sell, and their break fee was $43,000. It was a really bitter pill to swallow, but because the rates were high, they had actually gotten that loan out when rates were a little bit high back when you bought your home, and then they declined quite quickly after that. So the economic loss for the break fee was high to the bank. If the rates are similar, the break fee might be less, but if you fix high and then break low, you could have a very big cost involved. So you need to look out for that.
Okay, so in terms of points to consider, what they need to consider is the difference between what the original interest rate that you signed up for compared to the current interest rate environment, and if there's a massive difference, so therefore the banks lose money. And then what if you have a fixed rate loan and you just signed up for it, and like 12 months later, or not even 12 months, like 2 months later, if you break that, so the earlier you break it, I assume the penalties would be higher.
That's right, because it goes over a period of time. So the longer you fix for, it could be the bigger the break fees are. My personal preference is I like to keep my entire portfolio variable. I like to be fluid. I like to be able to change banks if I want to. I like to be able to buy and sell without penalty. I never know what I'm doing in the next few years. So unless I knew exactly what my 5-year plan was, I don't feel like fixing would be for me. But I do have clients come to me, but they know that they're buying this house, they're not moving, they know their income's going to be stable for the next 5 years, they're not inheriting any money from anywhere. So fixing might be right for them because they'd like to know what their repayments are every fortnight for the next 5 years.
Right. Slight sidetrack question about the fixed rate environment. Why is it that in Australia we can't fix it for that 20, 30-year period, whilst in America, and I think some other countries, they can do it? I'm just curious, have we ever been able to fix it for that period, or in Australia that's just never happened?
I've seen a fixed rate at 15 years before when I worked for the bank, but that's the highest I've ever seen. I just can't imagine, because there's these penalties involved. I mean, who knows that they're not going to sell a house for 15 years? It would just be, I think, just the way their mortgages work are different.
How interesting. So shout out to all the Americans who fixed their home loan at 1.99% just 3 years ago for 30 years. They're laughing at us right now. Now, what about, we've got a fair few listeners who have commercial property, who have, they want to buy a retail precinct or whatever it is that they want to buy, or industrial sort of properties. Is the process for commercial property in terms of mortgage broking, is it kind of similar, or are there separate specialist mortgage brokers that deal with that separately?
Yeah, look, it's actually a little bit different. So we have a commercial broker in our team and she works a lot with the medical profession. And commercial is traditionally the banks see commercial property as a little bit higher risk than residential property. It has more vacancy over time. And so as a result, they will go, well, we'll lend less of a percentage and we will maybe shade the rent a little bit more when we're taking it into consideration for serviceability. But if you're a medical professional, sometimes that's different because you're a medical professional, the risk is low. If you're buying a commercial property and you're going to put a dental practice or a GP in there, they know that it's pretty low risk. So they have different rules for you than they do as if you're buying that to put in a cafe. So we financed a couple of GPs actually were working, a clinic and that clinic was getting sold and they came to us and said, can we buy this clinic? We don't really have a whole lot of money, but we've worked here for a long time and we want to know what our options are. We were able to they pulled their super and bought the building in their super fund and they essentially borrowed 100% overall for the clinic and they just sort of started operating. But the bank could look at that case and say, well, you've been the GPs in this clinic. We know that this is what the profit's going to be. So, you know, they pretty much did 100% lend overall on that. Another case would have been a physiotherapist was looking at building a building and it would have had him build a 6-room clinic, but he only had 2 rooms in the place that he was renting. His income and his financials nowhere near service the build that we were looking at putting together. But we could look at rooms. So we go, well, there's 2 rooms in this physio's clinic and this is the profit he's got. We can see that he's already working at capacity. With the 6 rooms, this is what he would earn. So we sat down with his accountant. We both worked out some projections. We got some spreadsheets together for the bank and we put projections with 6 rooms, what the profitability of the company would be then. And that's how we financed it. We did a lend based on his projected income of what the rooms would be. Now, if that was a beauty therapist, there's no way the bank's going to let me look at how many rooms there's going to be and projected incomes. That's something that's quite specific for the medical profession.
Right. So in terms of risk, again, commercial property, healthcare, generally lower risk.
It's much lower risk.
Okay. What about things like childcare centres? Surprisingly, I've got a colleague who is now building a GP centre, a 15-room centre or something like that. But he's also going to build a childcare centre. I don't know why, but he says apparently that's a very profitable industry. Are running childcares also low risk or like where does the risk profile sit with that?
So the banks would lend for childcare centres a little differently to they would to a medical centre. It's not classified as low risk, but there I do see a lot of childcare centres getting built. And I mean, I guess they're seen as, people are looking and researching if they can do them in or out of super.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. So good luck to him. It's just a bizarre sort of strategy. But anyway, shout out if you're listening, Dr. VP. What about things like restaurants? A lot of healthcare workers, they love this idea about setting up their own restaurant, which always worries me because, you're a doctor, you're not really a specialist in restaurant business. How does that sort of feature in terms of availability of funds to borrow, et cetera, in terms of risk profile?
I have not seen a doctor borrow for a restaurant. That blows my mind. Do they really invest in restaurants?
So you'd be surprised what doctors and healthcare workers invest in and also want to invest in. They have these aspirations of being a restaurant owner, aspirations of being a childcare operator. It's just a bit bizarre. And the circle of competence always worries me. Like stick to your circle of competence.
So I always think about the profitability too, if they did something in their own field of how much more profitable were there. But if they wanted to do a restaurant, I guess the benefit they'd have is that their own income as a GP or a specialist or whatever that may be is going to be seen as low risk. So And also they'd be able to go at a higher LVR on their own properties to be able to fund whatever business they were going into. So they're still going to be seen as a lower risk as somebody with no medical background opening a restaurant. I just want to have a really good chat to them about that restaurant first.
Yeah. So shout out to Anil, who runs the local restaurant near my house. It's a local Indian restaurant. I won't mention the restaurant name because otherwise people know where I live. But he's been our family restaurant for years now. We go to him quite often. And he tells me it's a really cutthroat business. It's actually not that. It's really hard to run a restaurant because a lot of it's after hours, a lot of it's weekends. So good luck to any doctors or nurses or healthcare workers wanting to run a restaurant. It's really, really tough. And he said the profit margins aren't great. So
it must be his passion.
Must be his passion. Although I think he might soon sort of sell up because I think unfortunately, you know, most people do take out and it's just so expensive to run a floor space. And also staff costs a lot of money and the wages that he pays, you know, are quite significant. Now that sort of comes to the end of the episode. I mean, I think we've covered a fair bit, an hour and 10 minutes, a pretty detailed, in-depth assessment about the mortgage broking business and costs of actually going through that process. Have we missed anything obvious? Is there anything that you'd like to say to listeners, you know, watch out for this or any red flags?
Yeah, the only thing I'd like to say is that it's never too soon to talk to a mortgage broker. I think it's really important, even if you're not ready to move now, don't hesitate to book in an appointment to talk to a broker. I feel like they work alongside you until you're ready to go. And so don't feel like, oh, I don't want to waste somebody's time. I'm not ready to do something for 6 months. Why don't you make sure that all have that appointment sooner rather than later and make sure that you're taking over the next 6 months while you're getting ready are the correct ones. So it's always good to have a check-in and don't worry.
Yeah, well said. I think that's important. I mean, you know, traditionally the teaching is everyone should have a family doctor and you should check in with your family doctor for preventative advice, maybe twice a year. Everyone should have a family lawyer. Everyone should have a family accountant. And everyone should have a family mortgage broker because it's something that's becoming more and more common. And on that note, everyone probably should also have a family personal insurance advisor because, again, all of these sort of professions really are guardrails because if you're sick, you can't make money and you can't make wealth. If you make the wrong financial decision in terms of buying a house, then you're kind of stuck. So I think it's important. So well said, absolutely important. So mortgage broking and personal insurance brokers, add that to the list to surround yourself with advisors. And it doesn't cost anything, just maybe once a year, check in. So thank you very much, Rachel. Really appreciate you joining us from Sphere Home Loans, and your details will be in the show notes
for thank anyone you for that's having interested. Me.
No worries. Thank you very much. Now, remember to leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts for Dev Raga Personal Finance. If you want to leave a 5-star on all of the platforms, that's even better. And please leave a positive review. And if you're in the market for a home, please reach out to either Rachel or your mortgage broker to make sure that you get those ducks in order before you make that first bid. It's really important. And like always, until next time, my name's Dev Raga. This is Dev Raga Personal Finance. Please make sure you stay safe.
We acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands on which we live and work and pay respects to their elders past, present and emerging. We extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who may listen to this podcast. This podcast is for education and entertainment purposes. Any advice is general financial advice only, which does not take into account your objectives, financial situation or needs. Because of that, you should consider if the advice is appropriate to you and your needs before acting on the information. If you do choose to buy a financial product, read the product disclosure statement, target market determination and obtain appropriate financial advice tailored to your needs. Symo Interactive Proprietary Limited, the publisher of the podcast, and Glenn James are authorised representatives of Money Sherpa Proprietary Limited, which holds financial services license 451289.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.